Is in my autonomic nervous system, I think.
I went down the Green River in Colorado once with friends, and you have to bring your water with you because you could purify the river, but if you've ever been on the Green, it's so full of sediments, you can't do it. And my friends said at the very end of the trip, two physicians actually, they said, I forgot how much water Hansen drinks. So that's me, so I do tend to drink a lot. Okay, so we did that practice, right? And just to mention it again, the talks and the practices will be freely offered on Dharma Seed, and I believe that their website is dharmaseed.org, D-H-A-R-M-A-S-E-E-D, dharmaseed.org. And so if you want to get those practices, a couple of people have come up to me about that, they'll be available there. So, how about, would anyone, a couple, three people maybe care to share or ask a question or make a comment, perhaps related to the practices, and then we'll slide into some other good stuff too. How about first behind you, then maybe we'll move forward, yeah.
thanks for that. So, me, when I meditate, the biggest challenge is always the narrative. You know, I'm doing this, now I'm doing that, and yeah, on and on and on. I found this type of meditation to be much easier for me, as opposed to a concentrative type.
Right.
So I'm just curious in terms of the brain, what are the different benefits of the two different types? Mm.
Okay. So thinking about the contrast between, let's say, as it's classically called, a focused attention practice. That's what you'll see in the research sometimes on meditation. You lock onto a breath or a tone or a saying, and that's just what you do. Or more so-called open awareness practice, which was what we did more of just before lunch. All right. In reality, they tend to blur together. Traditionally, interestingly, focused attention practices are taught first, usually, because you have to build up that muscle of attention to be able to just open wide to the whole stream coming through without being swept away by it. And it is interesting that often in the West, people jump to an open awareness practice, just sitting. To some extent, MBSR is an open awareness practice, mindfulness-based stress reduction. And great, but it's often pretty challenging for people. And my own practice, there have been probably at least three major things that have been helpful around it, interestingly, in the last 20 years. I'll tell you the other two in a second. But the first of those was when a teacher of mine, Christina Feldman, said, "What about concentration?" Often, sometimes, it's as if people are talking about the Noble Sevenfold Path. You know, they leave off right concentration, which is the jhanas, these non-ordinary states of awareness. So concentration is really important. But the ultimate aim, as Rick pointed out in the beginning, is liberating insight. That's the heartwood, if you will, of Buddhist practice. So, first point, it does help to have that muscle of concentration. On the other hand, once you have that muscle developed, or maybe it's just your own nature, Rick momentarily will get into talking about neurological diversity, different types of attentional profiles. And if it's more your nature to just be really served by just kind of relaxing into being here, and sustaining presence moment after moment after moment, fantastic. I think one thing that does happen, as you said about narrative, often concentration feels initially, especially in the beginning, driven by top-down executive control networks. And those executive control networks in the vast network of the brain are very connected with inner speech. We kind of talk ourselves off the ledge. We talk ourselves through problem solving. The inner speaking is often very linked to the inner advising, the inner criticizing, the inner prodding, all the rest of that. It's very linked to that executive control system. And a key note in that system, Rick showed you a slide, is that frontal portion of the cingulate cortex. So one way to be skillful with your own brain a little bit is to have just enough knowledge to know what's connected to what, and to realize that if you have a network with, let's say, three elements to it, the executive control system that's directing attention, second, the anterior cingulate cortex, that's monitoring any deviation from plan. And third, let's say these verbal centers, which for right-handed people, half of all lefties, roughly, are on the left side. So you have these three things. If you start activating one, those activations tend to reverberate through the whole system, which on the other hand tells you that if you can deactivate one, those reverberations tend to move through the whole system. So it could be, especially for some people, that doing a certain kind of top-down concentration practice reverberates into and starts activating this inner chatter. So then by getting out of the three of those, or at least two out of the three, into more of an open awareness practice with these lateral networks could really help you. And finishing, maybe again, too much inside baseball here, or too much inside the Zafu here, I don't know. But if you recall the description of the jhanas, in the first one, applied and sustained attention are present, which probably are very localized to the anterior cingulate cortex, that orange blob that Rick showed us in that slide. On the other hand, in the second jhana, applied and sustained attention fall away. And probably at that point, what's happening is that there's a stability of presence, a steadiness of mind that no longer needs any top-down instruction or direction whatsoever. Executive control is no longer needed to stay absorbed. And to me, it's possible that as we train in these open awareness states, these lateral network states, we will be able increasingly to rest in being present without much top-down control, which also would be associated with not much sense of self.
Right.
And as they say in both Death Row and the monastery, no self, no problem. You know, so, okay. That was a lot. Hopefully okay. Okay, another person right there.
Patch, what do I pointed at my mouth?
If you tap it, you can tell if it's on. There you go.
I didn't actually have a question.
Oh, comment?
There's just a small comment about the Dharma Seed. There's actually an app, and it's free, and you can download it if you have an iPhone. Mm. I don't know if it works on other smartphones, but it's really nice because then you can sort of listen to it out into the world.
Oh,
and
cool.
You can access past talks here and other places. That's it.
That's good. Thank
That's all
you.
I wanted
so,
to say.
An app for Dharma Seed, which knowing them is probably free. So. There you are. Oh, that's great. Okay, another comment or question or how? Where? Or over there? The big tall hand, the kind of a, there you are, that's one. What's that color? Sort of reddish, rust. One of my wife's favorite colors, by the way.
Could you comment on the difference between meditating with eyes open and meditating with eyes closed as far as how that affects all of this brain functioning that you're talking about?
Great.
Quick question.
Throw down on that? Or?
Yeah, actually, there are a couple things. One is that two or three people have come up to me in the break during lunch and talked about when they have their eyes closed that they're seeing all kinds of shapes and forms and colors. First off, 40% of your brain is occupied in processing visual material. And that being said, if you're trying to deal with distraction, the visual material is going to be terribly distracting. It's better to have your eyes closed. If you're trying to deal with falling asleep, probably better keep your eyes open. Again, you know, sort of doing a little riff on the answer that Rick gave for the last question, this is all about skillful means for the moment that you are in. The meditative practices have been done both ways. The visual practice is just not to name anything you see. You know, just let it be form, shape, and color. It's hard. The my own experience, and probably similar to everybody else's, meditating with your eyes open is much harder to do. The stuff that happens with your eyes, the one final thing I started with that, the stuff that happens with your eyes closed, you start, sometimes for me it's an expanding mandala thing of color, but it may be different for other people. It's just the occipital cortex. Once you've cut off that input, that 40% of your brain has nothing else to do. So it's, remember, it's still going to be electrically active. It's still going to be going, and so it'll give you all kinds of entertainment. So you'll do mandalas, your grandmother will show up, all kinds of stuff. And there's a really excellent book out that just came out, I think, by Oliver Sacks, maybe, I don't know if people are aware of it, called Hallucinations, where he takes the visual, the auditory, the olfactory, the somatic, hallucination senses, and reifies them, makes them part of normal experience. It's just what the brain's doing with electrical activity. And so for those of you who haven't read it, go find a copy. It is, as typical with Oliver's books, incredibly entertaining and incredibly informative. And you will never think about your brain the same way.
Okay, great. Maybe another couple. How about woman in the white thing there, right next to the...
The use of guided meditations in terms of neurobiology and efficacy of meditation?
Well, we did it. She's holding it up.
No, right. You're right.
We got to be for it.
No, that's right. He said junk. I don't know. What were you thinking? No. Ask for a refund. No. If you think of it, when we're guided, we get the plus, if you will, of the direction of someone who has hopefully something to offer. Otherwise, we wouldn't want to be guided by them. And we also get their voice and their qualities. I remember being on a drive recently, and I had on my iPhone a talk from Christina Feldman. And I was able to, actually it was on a CD, so I ran it through my car at the time. And I know Christina well, and just hearing her English accent, to her it's not an accent, I have an American accent to her, anyway. Talk about selfing, but there you go. But it entrained me into a good place. It inducted me into a good place. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, I think that... there's something very powerful in being able to self-direct one's own practice without any guidance at all. And then I think people kind of vary in how they are about it. I know people who really like guided practices. I know other people, and I tend to be among them, who would really kind of prefer to paddle around my own way, you know, in the pool, even if I'm sinking. So it just really depends on the person. One thing I'll just finish on this point. To play off this little riff, I had a teacher of mine a long time ago say that we're always stealing from each other, so steal the gold. In other words, we're always influenced by each other. We all dependently arise and pass away. And so then the question becomes, what are the influences that we want to cultivate in our lives, wholesome or unwholesome, for better or worse? And so since we're always cultivating influences, why not be thoughtful about the useful ones? And then that goes to the larger point, really, I think the takeaway for Rick and for me of this whole workshop day, which has to do with this question, what are the causes you want to cultivate inside your own mind? And then how can you get those causes going by cultivating them inside your brain? Mm-hmm. That's it. What are the causes? And for me... I like being, as I know, a deeply social animal. I like internalizing and cultivating a whole committee inside my mind. Actually, a whole menagerie of loving lizards and well-fed rats and gregarious monkeys. Just all going there, you know. Shh. And I hear their voices in my ear.
I'm just having fun in Rick's zoo. It's great.
But the thing is, we got it. What do you want inside your head? You know, Nurse Ratched or Mr. Rogers? I have Mr. Rogers front and center. So, okay, that's all I want to say about. And that's what's nice about guided practices. You can kind of get those things inside your head. Okay. Maybe one more person. Woman in front right there in red.
Before your question, I'm just going to give one quick riff, which is going back to the meditations and the neuroscience piece in regards to guided meditation. Mantra meditation with people doing TM shows the same kind of lateral network, medial network changes, shows the same kind of anterior cingulate with a little piece of language cortex over here going you know, mantra, 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 mantra. So this, the language cortex is, can be working with a guided imagery meditation and have it not interfere with attaining any state you want.
Yeah, to just, if I could, in a sense, the essence, to use a certain language here, is to activate useful mental states and then install them as useful neural traits,
right,
which we then reactivate later when we need them, which gives us another opportunity to install them. And that rhythm, activation, installation, reactivation, reinstallation, is really it's a kind of neurologically informed way to talk about practice.
Mm-hmm.
And since the brain is continually changing its structure, for better or worse, and since, frankly, it's extra vulnerable to changing for the worse, it's really on us, I think, to be thoughtful about the wholesome states that we're activating, including the wholesome state of choiceless witnessing awareness. That's another wholesome state. So we're activating wholesome states, and then we're trying to take in the good to get them to sink into our, you know, brain. And that rhythm is, to me, a very useful way to think about it. And to also never underestimate the power of the dark side of the force. In other words, that a lot of these negative states, they're staining our brain even as they sit in our brain, even as they sit in our mind, rather. And past the point it's useful, I think pain is overrated. You know, for I grew up in LA, there are a lot of people there who want to get rid of pain. I get that. But for every person I've ever met who problematically, I think, is just resisting their pain and trying to leap to happiness, I probably know 5 or 10 more, frankly, who are hanging out with more pain than they really need to and are doing less than they could on their own behalf to plant more flowers in the garden of the mind. And I think to some extent there's been this kind of passivity, if you will, with regard to the mind that's invaded the mindfulness world. And to some extent, Buddhism. And it's not in the traditional practices. The Buddha talks a lot about being resourceful, including engaging wise effort, you know, with the mm-hmm. mind. And frankly, taking up arms against our oppressors, most of whom live between the ears. Okay. Thanks. Last person.
Yeah. With regard to the open awareness practice, I have had now on two occasions, once in a 20-minute sit and once during a 10-day long, where there was just awareness. There was no self, there was no breath. The breath was there, but it wasn't mine. There was no body, and it was blissful. It was absolutely blissful. I don't know if we're going to talk about that or not, but I'm curious about what we're activating in the brain and what that all means. And I know the attachment, I want to go back there, and it's only happened twice. And,
yeah.
You know, I'm just curious about that state.
Well, thank you, and beautiful that one could... that anyone could have that, and that you did have that. I think the truth is that the neurology of this is not well understood. People conjecture about it. Rick's going to talk a little bit about some of the possibilities of that. I'll say one thing that I find really quite helpful from a practical standpoint. How do we make ourselves accident prone? You know, to those states. I hope you'll indulge me. This will take about 5 minutes to do it, and it's transformed my own personal practice. This is based on a really remarkable piece of work from he's a neurologist like Rick, and also a longtime Zen practitioner named James Austin. And the book I'm referring to here is Selfless Insight. It's his third book. His first book is Zen Brain. It's about this big. People use it as a doorstop. My copy sits underneath my computer monitor trying to give it some mojo. Selfless Insight's more readable than he has a fourth book, which is even tighter. Succinctly here, in our brain, you could think of it as two sort of fundamental networks. One is egocentric, self-referential. The other is allocentric, which is impersonal and not self-oriented. The egocentric network activates around things that are close to us, that could be personally relevant, especially if they're threatening, and to some extent if they could be rewarding. That makes sense. The allocentric neural network, and these are normal neural networks, we all have this, them, tends to activate with things that are farther away, above the sight line to the horizon, so looking up, right? And there's not much sense of self present in the allocentric moment. Second, those networks intertwine with attention networks. And attention basically has two kind of related networks. One, and there are three functions of attention, two of which are in one network. The first function of attention is alerting. Something's happened. I've no idea what it is. I don't know where it is. Something has happened. And you can track that in your mind. There's been a sound, right? Something happened. Second is orienting. That's the second function of attention. We orient, we locate. And think about a squirrel in the wild. There's something's happened. Where is it? What is it? Friend or foe? And then orienting. And then the beginning of the attentional process is around responding and starting to begin to mobilize a response. Those are the three aspects of attention. The first of those, the purely orienting, intertwines greatly with the allocentric network. Pardon me, the purely alerting is allocentric. Orienting and responding is more intertwining with egocentric. Okay. Now we get to the practical implications. First of all, open awareness practice, if you think of it, is when, in its epitome, it's a pure alerting practice. Something has happened. Something has happened. Something has happened. I don't know what it is. I don't know where it is. I don't need to know what it is or where it is. Something is impinging on the windshield of consciousness as time moves through me or I move through time. That's all it is. So by strengthening a pure open awareness practice, by cultivating shikantaza, just sitting practice, or choiceless awareness practice, we strengthen the attentional networks that are involved in alerting, which also strengthen the capacity to go into allocentric, not self, very peaceful, oneness states, first. Second, there's a natural rhythm in which there's a little switch in the thalamus, which is like this switchboard in the brain that's handling sensory processing. So in any minute, we normally oscillate a few times a minute between allocentric, egocentric, allocentric, egocentric. There's kind of a switch in the thalamus that does this. A couple points here. First point, that switch is controlled by a neurotransmitter called GABA, which is an inhibitory neurotransmitter associated with relaxing and calming. So it's plausible. Now we're starting, everything I've said so far is well-established, well-evidenced science. Now we're starting to move more into plausible, pragmatic speculation. And I'm building on what Austin has done. So it's plausible that as we cultivate tranquility and long exhalations and parasympathetic activation and kind of an inner peace, we will get more GABA neurotransmitter flow that will tend to stimulate these little nodes to be set more on allocentric as to egocentric. That's a practical takeaway. So far I've got two practical takeaways. Open awareness practice strengthens the alerting networks and that also support allocentric awareness. Two, tranquility, cultivating tranquility also promotes probably these little switches inside the thalamus that would be more inclined toward the allocentric setting. Okay. Third, getting more comfortable with allocentric processing, so it's not so alarming to have less sense of self and to be more relaxed around feeling kind of coextensive out into allness could also help us be more comfortable with allocentric. And then here comes Austin. He asks, because he's a Zen guy, what's the neurology of Kensho or Satori? I love questions like that. Like, what the heck's going on? You know, what's going on in the brain of a Buddha? Okay?
The answer to that is Mu.
move. So you have this state in Zen. Kensho is sort of like a oneness experience that's stable. And what's interesting about Kensho and Satori, it rarely happens during formal practice. It usually happens in nature. It often happens when there's surprise, and it often happens when a person's gaze is above the horizon line. Yeah. So, here's Austin's theory. We have this normal cycling. There's an internal clock, or ticker, if you will, that moves us back and forth, allocentric, egocentric, which makes sense from a survival standpoint. Big picture, allocentric, you know, seeing me is just one more animal in a total surround, and then egocentric, from this perspective, you know, what's relevant to me, allocentric. It's normal to have this rhythm. So allocentric, egocentric. With training, the allocentric peaks can get higher and higher. Allocentric, egocentric, allocentric, egocentric, allocentric, egocentric. Okay? And if hypothetically we get something happens that surprises us at the peak of an allocentric peak, kapoom. His theory is that that little switch inside the thalamus gets stuck on oneness. Cool stuff. So again, as Rick said in the beginning, all we can do really is tend to the causes that make us prone to grace, accident prone, if you will. But to me, those are three practical takeaways. Training an open awareness that strengthens the alerting aspect of attention. Cultivating tranquility, that's not numbness. Cultivating tranquility. And third, through insight and through other means, becoming more comfortable with boundaries, relaxing, and being more coextensive with oneness or emptiness in the technical sense. That can then make us more accident prone. And every so often, look up to the horizon line. Isn't that the sweetest stuff? Okay. All right. Onward. Okay? Good stuff. Okay, so now, bingo, Rick's going to talk about the real diversity.
The real diversity.
Neurological. The non-socially constructed aspects of diversity.
What's going on? So, this is sort of, these two slides actually are just a quick review of where we were going with attention. That how the brain pays attention, it holds on to information. It comes into the moment, holding some memory of what's been going on. There's an updating function of awareness. In other words, something just happened that's important, I need to pay attention to it. And then once that's faded, then there's sort of a recycle. It's time to seek stimulation, time to move on to the next mind moment. And there's an internal clock that drives that cycle, that seeks the next mind moment, seeks the next mind moment. I think we skipped.
Oh, we saw that one already?
That one.
This is a busy slide. But
it's a busy slide. Remember I talked a little earlier that the evolution of the human brain over the last several tens and hundred thousands of years has been in synaptic connections and the postsynaptic membrane, presynaptic membrane, release of neurotransmitters, modulation of neurotransmitters. There is tremendous literature to say that particular kinds of, say, for example, serotonin transmitters, if you have a particular population, you tend to be more risk-taking. If you have other kinds of serotonin transmitters, you tend to be more risk-averse. Now, for all of the neurotransmitters in the brain that we come up against, for GABA, for serotonin, for dopamine, for norepinephrine, for estrogen, progesterone. There's not just one receptor for this. There is an entire population of neurotransmitter receptors distributed in multiplicity of circuits on the brain. So when you get literature out there saying that this is a serotonin reuptake inhibitor drug, in what circuit, involving what transmitters, What's going to be going on with the serotonin in the spinal cord? What's going to be going on with the serotonin in the amygdala? What's going on to the serotonin in the hippocampus? What's going on to the serotonin in the cortex? That tells you a lot about where its major effect is. Most of the SSRIs are pretty much in limbic system,
causing a greater amount of equanimity, a sort of a sense of distance, and a much more kind of pleasant life, which is why they work as antidepressants. But what are all those other things doing? Well, that one drug is going to go to all those different places. It's going to, in some cases, improve synaptic connections in some circuits, totally muck it up in another. And that's where you get all the side effects. So you get put on Prozac and you feel good, but you gain 40 pounds. You know, that kind of thing. Well, okay, in the mood center for emotion, you know, you feel better. In the appetite center, Yahoo, IHOP, here I come. So,
are you going back to those pancakes when you were 12 in New Mexico?
No, I'm going back to 2 weeks ago when my two kids said, "We're going to IHOP for dinner." I said,
"For dinner?
Okay." Funny face pancake with chocolate. I had the dietetic omelet. What can I tell you? Anyway, so there is a tremendous difference in the neurochemistry and the effects of these various transmitters between human being to human being to human being to human being. And you're going to inherit these, obviously, because these neurotransmitters come from your parents. In addition, and this is a total speculative riff on my part, but I think it's okay to throw out, these receptor sites, the receptor for the neurochemistry, for the neurotransmitter, that receptor is a 5 or 6 member protein ring that puts a hole in the membrane of the neuron. Okay, neuron is this membrane that's kind of an insulating sheath. Then you have these proteins that go from the outside to the inside of the cell, and there's a hole in the center. Can it be this big or this big or this big? If it's this big, it lets a certain amount of sodium or potassium or chloride or calcium go through. If it's that big, it ain't happening. Well, that's made up of, say, 5 or 6 member protein. Each one of those proteins is a genetically coded thing, just like every other protein in your body. So you inherit these proteins. So you inherit your particular characteristics. In addition, the part of the DNA that's read that reads these proteins changes as you get older. So your serotonin 5-HT2 receptor at age 6 is probably not the same sequence of protein, of amino acids, as the one at age 70. On the one hand, you'd say, "What do you mean?" But wait a second, do you expect your 70-year-old to behave like a 6-year-old? No. There are certain behaviors that go along as we age. So if you play with that a little bit, pretty soon every Jungian archetype comes equipped with its own genetic set of neurotransmitter receptors coded by your DNA. And therefore, our assumption that we are in control of our behaviors, of how we age, of childhood, adolescence, adult, and old age, they're no different than the programmed behavior of any other organism on the planet. We talk about the kind of things of why geese can fly, you know, thousands of miles in a particular direction and migrate. It's, quote, programmed into that brain is about that big. Okay? And it's done in certain times and then not in others. And so why should we make the assumption that we as a species are any different? We're not. So that's a whole oversight riff. Now, where do you fit in this system as a consequence of what you inherited in your genetics and what time of life you are? And furthermore, just to even make it more complicated, make it 5 dimensions, what experiences you've had and what experiences your parents have had, because there's this thing called epigenetics that determines there are little pieces now of DNA that determine what part of the chromosome gets read. So if it's going to do that, okay. Suppose your parents did certain things and you get an epigenetically somewhat transferred system and you wind up as a more thrill-seeking person as a consequence of some parental experience. So there's this whole question, and this is a whole argument in the literature at this point, there's this whole questionable Lamarckian, Lysenko, is stuff that's outside the DNA actually transferred through the generations that we don't really know the complete answer for yet. So now I've made it very complicated. Thank you, Rick. But the problem, and this goes again back to what we were talking about today, and you know we've done certain practices. At Spirit Rock, there are teachers that teach lots and lots and lots of other kinds of practices. And as the Buddha said, see for yourself. Why? Well, suppose I'm high on holding information, I'm sort of flexible on updating awareness, and I'm stuck in a rut from sinking stimulation. That's me. That's my neurotransmitter system. Now, I'm not going to tell you right at the present time which dopamine receptor, which serotonin receptor, which norepinephrine receptor you are in, or whether or not you've just gone through menopause and your estrogen receptors in your hippocampus are crying out for help. Because that's actually true. That's one of the density of estrogen receptors, by the way, complete sideline. The density of estrogen receptors in the brain is highest in the hippocampus, which is probably that most men should get up in the morning and say, God help me. Because estrogen's an activating neurotransmitter. It upregulates neuronal function. And it may be one of the reasons that when he says, I don't remember, it's actually probably true, and it's probably a reason why she does. So that just a little sidebar. But so you have a population of inherited and experience altered neurotransmitters that makes you somewhat unique. The positive message from today's experience is that you can change your brain. The dark side of this is that the first piece before you change it is you got to accept where you are. You're not going to become an arahant and then go try to learn to meditate. That's not how it works. That you have to accept who you are in here. You have to select the appropriate practices based on bumping into them and seeing if they work for you right now. Seeing for yourself. And then make that decision. So this is the whole thing about diversity in here. I mean, we're not all the same height. We don't have the same hair color. We don't have the same eye color. We don't have the same skill set. And even further, in terms of child development, there's this famous sort of cliche that gets thrown out there, is that your first child absolutely makes you believe in nurture.
Me, big dad. Me know how to raise children.
Your second, third, and fourth kids make you absolutely believe in nature. Oh, my God. I did it with him. What's wrong with you? And that's the piece that there's this sort of radical acceptance of yourself as an individual with your own foibles, your own problems. Start from where you are, and take the practices, with good heart, with as much intelligence as you can muster. See if they work for you as an experience, and keep going. Use the experiences as long as they are satisfactory. When they cease to move you along, drop them. And the whole piece in the going through the formed and the formless jhanas, if you go through the Buddhist suttas and you look at it, what happens for the practitioner, and the Buddhist exhorts his monks several times to do this, never get stuck in one jhana and assume you've made it, because that's not it. You drop that, you drop that, you drop that, you drop that. You drop that till you've dropped everything. And that's finally where you get to enlightenment. That's finally the piece of awakening. It's just everything literally has to drop away in terms of your attachment to it. This medial circuit's I, me, mine has to literally let go of all of these things, some of which you may have spent 30 years on the Zafu acquiring, if it no longer meets the goal of moving you forward toward this. My riff.
That's good. And I think one of the key takeaways here, if you're someone who, as many people are in the culture, needs more stimulation than is available in just the sensations of breathing, it's really okay to increase the stimulation by being aware of the whole body breathing or bringing in something that's more warm-hearted, like loving kindness practice or compassion practice, or feeling cared about kind of practice. If you think of it to simplify that cool, complex thing that Rick just did there, for me, I think of sort of like the normal temperamental spectrum in any tribe, if you will. If you have, you know, turtles at one end who are sort of anxious and rigid and careful on the one hand, and then you have jackrabbits at the other end of the spectrum, more spirited, hyper, ADD territory, all right, and a lot of tweeners, the tribe needs all type. The tribe needs all types. The problem is a lot of contemplative practices have been devised by turtles for turtles to build better turtles in turtle pens.
And it only works if you do turtle. If you do jackrabbit as a turtle, if you are a jackrabbit, you got to do turtle.
That's right. You just need to become a better turtle. Well, maybe you just need to be a good jackrabbit who's also totally awake. So, so my point is, then we'll take the comment, then we'll do a practice here about this. I think it's really okay to appreciate the diversity, if you will, of temperament, and to adapt practices for those purposes. And I think that's one of the very important things that is coming into spiritual centers, and in particular Buddhist centers, to appreciate the ways in which that there are many different ways to practice, particularly given our different brains. Okay, one comment that we'll do a practice. Yeah.
In terms of the last column, the seeking stimulation,
and the internet, can you comment a little bit about there, or maybe throw out a couple of references in terms of what's happening in our culture, in the world, with the internet and the effects neurologically, and what about, how's that going to affect meditation and the brain? Is that too big?
That's no, pretty big. I'll say something briefly.
Okay.
And then we'll
meditation
move
on. Is a great antidote to the internet. That's my takeaway, and I'll let Rick expand on it.
Well, it's a controversial area, and I think you're aware of that. It's hard to run natural experiments. We can't have the control planet next to the internet, you know, planet, right? Research does tend to show that access to technology confers cognitive benefits to older people.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there's always a question, how big is that benefit, and could it be achieved through other means? The most, basically the most stimulating object for human beings is another human face. We're very organized in that way. So if you think about what's stimulating, you know, holding hands with a dear friend, walking through a neighborhood through a different route, that's very, very stimulating. So including cognitively or intellectually and linguistically if you're talking with each other. So I think there are many ways to get that. On the other hand, there is research that shows that especially if you have more vulnerable people, typically young, aggressive males, and you do a lot of video type games that play on stimulation seeking and immediate reward and aggressiveness, you're going to train the brain in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
My own personal view about that is that much of media these days is habituating us to a very fast baud rate, a very dense incoming stream. And so it's kind of like giving candy to children. Apples no longer taste sweet. And that's cautionary for me. I think we evolved, if you think about it, to go to Rick's point, the life's about 3.5 billion years old on the planet. Nervous system about 600 million, mammals about 200 million, primates about 40 million-ish, depending on the categories. Stone tool manufacturing hominids, it's been pushed back over 3 million years ago. Hunter-gatherers like ourselves, genetically, around 150,000 years. During that long run, until very, very recently, we lived life at the pace of a walk. And our interactions with each other were typically face-to-face, voice-to-voice, eye-to-eye. And that's what we evolved to do. And I'm a major fan of refrigeration and ibuprofen and ESPN. But, you know, I try to keep in mind that we're running, as a species, this extraordinary experiment with no control group that's historically completely unprecedented.
Right.
And I do worry about the effects of that, particularly on people that are more vulnerable. So to Rick's point, if we are going to play with fire, let's wear asbestos gloves. In other words, I think that's where a contemplative practice is particularly helpful. Because if you think of it, to the extent that this word means anything, our most fundamental property is that which is in our attention in this moment. And yet we're surrounded by the greatest minds of our generation devising ever more clever ways to steal our attention, to take it for their own purposes. And so to reclaim our own ownership of our attention and our authority over it through contemplative practice, to me, is absolutely front and center, especially in, you know, the 21st media saturated century.
Right. An additional corollary in that, then we'll move on, which is that if you look at what happens, attention is, as Rick pointed out earlier, is a dopamine mediated piece. And dopamine is the lush kind of reward transmitted in the rapture in the jhana states. Rapture probably correlates more closely to dopamine. But dopamine is a saturable neurotransmitter system, particularly going into the frontal lobes. And not only is it saturable, it is something that can be irreversibly damaged by excessive stimulation. One of the major consequences for people doing methamphetamine and crack cocaine use is that once they come off and they reform, nothing is pleasurable. The entire pleasure circuit has been fried, and it is like it has been stroked, and it does not come back. And so that's the piece that's not understood, because they chase it to the point where they damage the system, and then it's irrecoverable. If you look at that baud rate of transmission, not just in the internet, but in the video game, but if you watch a movie that has been edited, or a TV show that has been edited in the last 15 or 20 years, and compare it to a movie or a TV show that was done in the 60s, what's the refresh rate? You cannot find a shot in a current movie that's longer than a second and a half. You know, just go out and watch them. So what you get is that actor is going to deliver one line. But it flips to me. It flips to you. It flips to me. It goes bang, 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 bang. I mean, you can almost tell the year the movie was made from outside the house for the flicker rate on the curtains.
Even commercials.
Even commercials. Well, they're even more so because they really want to steal you.
Yeah. That's true. Well, let's regather our attention.
But I digress.
No, that's great. That's great. No, I mean, in general. Well, to that end, then, if it's okay, segueing into a practice, then we'll take a break, then we'll come back. Okay, so what are we going to do? Right? We have our own profile, and then we have, you know, we have culture and events and society coming in. This is where there's a place for self-compassion. And self-compassion through the internalization of feeling cared for can also help quiet and steady the mind. So here we have a quotation from Pema Chodron. She comes from a Tibetan tradition, but it's still very relevant. She says, the root of Buddhism is compassion. She means that as well as a warm-heartedness, a profound insight into the interdependence of everything, and the emptiness of any apparent single thing as it exists, but it's not self-arising on its own. Okay? The root of Buddhism is compassion in that sense, and the root of compassion is self-compassion, you know, getting on our own side. So I'm going to do a little practice with you, but first we're going to warm up the attachment circuits of the brain. See if you can find the fourth monkey. I don't have my laser pointer, but right in the middle, roughly, you see these two eyes looking out, one eye in particular, these little black dots. Oh yeah, and the little hand too. So now that we've really thoroughly warmed up, the inner monkey. And isn't it interesting that just an image like this, we arise dependently, right? For better or worse. And we're very affected by this kind of thing. I don't know about you, speaking of commercials, they'll do these ads for things like, you know, I knew my wife was pregnant when she cried at dog food commercials, you know. But we get very moved by these images. Okay, then segueing into self-compassion, a lot of words on the screen, try to stay with the monkeys. We'll do a practice momentarily. Compassion is the wish that a being not suffer, usually combined with an emotion of sympathetic concern, tender concern. Self-compassion is simply the application of that wish and that sweetness, that tenderness, to the being who wears our name tag. Okay. Much research shows that self-compassion is a very good inner resource, inner strength to cultivate, to activate, install, reactivate, reinstall. But for many people, it's really quite hard. We've probably known many people, we might be among them, who are much more likely to treat others well and generously and fairly and with kindness than they are to treat themselves well, with kindness and generosity. So cultivating self-compassion is a good thing. And to do this, I'm going to do this in four steps with you, starting with the experience of feeling cared for, and then second step, cultivating a sense of compassion for someone that it's easy to have compassion for or a caring stance toward, and then taking it in the third step to oneself, and then going all the way out to helping relax the deep kind of ancient engine of craving related to love, and relax it based on, to whatever extent you can, abiding and feeling loved enough. It would be great to be more loved, but loved enough. So that's the structure of the practice. And then we'll segue into a break and then come back and talk about it. Sound okay? Want to try this? Okay. So now I want to actually say something here, which is that in the associational networks of the brain, very often when you think about the donut, you think about the hole, right? So very often it's natural if we start calling up a sense of being cared for to also have an associated sense of not being cared for enough or by the right people or in the right way. And that's all right. The negative tends to call at our attention. The thing to do, I think generally in this kind of structured practice, is to note the negative material, not fight it, because then you just have more negative if you go negative on the negative. Be with it. Let it be, observe it, and then after a breath or two or three or ten, at some point, try to bring your attention back to whatever positive factor you're cultivating in your mind. Okay, so let's give it a whirl. So coming into being present here, eyes open or closed as you like, knowing that this practice in particular, and it's not the only way to meditate, obviously, is fairly active in terms of trying to cultivate things in the mind. As always, you're both trying to get something going, and second, you're observing what happens. So coming home to your own body and this moment, as a first step, building on something we did in the beginning today, in the morning, bring to mind someone that you know cares about you. It could be a human, could be an animal companion, it could be a spiritual entity or being or force, the divine altogether perhaps, It could be a being in your life or in your past. It could be a group of beings. It's okay to use more than one. And then using the calling to mind, the remembrance of these beings, to help kindle inside you, to help activate and get going, the felt sense of being cared about. Being cared about is on a kind of spectrum. It includes feeling like you belong. It includes feeling seen, feeling appreciated or respected. Feeling liked or feeling loved. Anywhere along that spectrum, any port in a storm. So I'll just be quiet for a few minutes here as you explore a kindness to yourself to kind of open to and help grow in the mind. It's a kind of mini concentration practice on feeling loved or cared about. You try to let this grow inside you as your own object of attention or absorption, feeling cared about. If you want, you could perhaps strengthen this experience with a hand on your heart or a hand on your cheek, as if the most cherishing and loving being in the universe was caressing you and letting you know it's okay, you are seen, you are cared about, we want you, you're one of us, we appreciate you. You've helped. We like you. We really, really like you. We love you because you are lovable. There might be a tender sweetness in the experience, or maybe a more of a raw, raw camaraderie with buddies. Maybe a feeling of being part of a group up against the wall together. It could be simply good times with friends. But whatever it is, also getting a sense of receiving, if you can. What's it like to feel loved? Kind of letting it land. I'm liked. I'm included. I'm seen in the ways that I am. I'm not denying the ways I have felt hurt or left out, but I'm acknowledging and experiencing the beautiful positive ways I've been included and cared for. And letting the sense of being cared for move to the back of the mind and bringing to mind someone that you naturally feel caring toward. Perhaps a friend or a child, perhaps someone who's suffering, who's sick or poor, mistreated, upset. Know what it's like to have a quality of compassion or kindness toward this other being. The wish that this other being not suffer. Perhaps strengthened with soft thoughts in your mind, like, may you not suffer. Or may you be healthy. May your chemotherapy go well. May you find food. May you find true love. So I'll be quiet here for a few moments as you explore what it's like to feel compassionate or kind toward one or more beings. Opening to love flowing through you. Not impeding it. And knowing what love feels like. Knowing what compassion or kindness or other forms of caring feel like for you. And in the third step, knowing what caring feels like, take the same caring and swing it over to yourself. If you like, you could imagine yourself as a little boy or girl, as a child, or yourself today. See if you can keep mobilizing good wishes for yourself. Wishing well, being tender, perhaps combined with soft thoughts like, may you not suffer, or perhaps something very specific, perhaps said to a young version of yourself, may you know that it's not your fault. May you know that it's about them really, not you. Or may you know that it will get better. Or may you know that you really are smart or beautiful or good. Know that you are loved. Perhaps the sense applied to yourself in your own way, but along the lines of, I feel your pain. I know you are hurting. And you are beautiful. And I wish you did not suffer. And then the last step, having explored love flowing in, then flowing out, then flowing in again, abiding increasingly simply as love. And abiding as love, love flowing in, love flowing out, love simply present as love. See if you can explore a kind of sort of survey of your life. The many people who have liked you, who have included you, who have seen you. And see if you can help yourself find your way to a sense of having been loved enough. It's perfectly fine to wish for even more love or even more of a special kind of love. But if you can, on the basis of feeling already loved enough, so that there's no need for any kind of unbalanced craving or clinging for more love. Or even if a strong longing for love still continues to arise, there can be an equanimity around it, an all rightness around some kind of unhappy clinging for love. So I'll be quiet here again for a few minutes as you see if you can help yourself come home to a place where there's no basis for craving love because you've already been loved enough. so that you can be at peace about love. Starting to wrap up here, see if you can find any sense of knowing what it's like to have a kind of contentedness about love. It would be nice to have more, or in different forms. It's fine to wish for that, while simultaneously being deeply peaceful and free with regard to love. In a moment, we'll take a break again, and then we'll come back. And again, if you want to keep practicing through the break, I think this is a good practice to use through the break. And when we come back, we'll explore the jhana factors, especially rapture, joy, and singleness of mind, with some more practices about that. So if you could, maybe a slightly quicker break. It seemed to be okay the last time. How about we return at 3:30? Sound okay? Come back at 3:30, please. See you soon. 15 minutes.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/ donate.